This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi guys, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is episode 41, Kalia McNabb, part 2. Last week, I told you about the disappearance of 14-day-old Kalia McNabb. Kalia's mother, Courtney Bell, made a frantic 911 call on the morning of Saturday, October 7th, 2017, to report that her newborn daughter was missing from the family's mobile home in Covington, Georgia. Erratic behavior on the part of the baby's father, Christopher McNabb, led investigators to consider him their primary person of interest. By the end of the day on October 7th, both Courtney and Chris had been interviewed by Newton County Sheriff's investigators, but without more evidence, no arrests could be made. After Kalia's body was found the following day, her father's eccentric behavior only intensified when he jumped out of a car and fled into the woods on foot, only to be captured hours later. Kalia's mother was arrested a few months afterward for contributing to the environment that led to her daughter's death. Courtney Bell and Chris McNabb were tried for their crimes in May of 2019. This is the conclusion of the tragic story of Kalia McNabb. My sources for today's episode were the Covington News, 11 Alive, WSB TV Channel 2 Atlanta, The Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Crime Online, Court TV, WGAU Radio, The Explore Georgia website, Wikipedia, Harwell Funeral Home, Court Documents, and Trial Footage. Before I get into part 2 of Kalia's story, please listen to this promo for another fantastic true crime podcast, Crime and Crime Again.
Hi, I'm Chelsea, the host of Crime and Crime Again. I cover the lesser-known cases that you may not have heard before. My goal is to tell the stories of the forgotten and be their voice when their own has been silenced. You can find Crime and Crime Again anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Give Chelsea a listen for lesser-known cases to pique your interest. I also want to give a shout-out to my newest patron, Kristen from Lawrenceburg, Indiana. Thank you so much, Kristen. Every pledge brings me closer to my goal of permanently devoting myself full-time to the podcast and to sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com, where I tell the stories of even more kids like Kalia, whose voices were silenced by the people who should have protected and cherished them. It means so much to me to have this platform to tell these kids' stories and help keep their memories alive. Now let's get into the conclusion of Kalia's story. While Kalia's parents were interviewed by investigators after her disappearance on October 7, 2017, other family members spoke with Channel 2 News. In this clip, Kalia's maternal grandfather, Tim Bell, and great-grandfather, Jack Bell, talk about the disappearance of the two-week-old girl.
Oh, my God. You know, just Mama. So sad. Just hurt. And there really ain't no words to say, you know. You don't know what you feel.
She wasn't no bigger than this little doll right here.
Just like it was before, it's still a waiting game, you know, to find out exactly what did happen.
Tears come to my eyes every time I think about it. She is just so precious, so innocent, so small, couldn't help herself.
Now, the worst part is, you know, is thinking, you know, the little baby laid out there, you know, all alone.
After their separate interviews at the Newton County Sheriff's Office, Kalia's parents, 24-year-old Courtney Bell and 27-year-old Christopher McNabb, were driven home by sheriff's deputies to their trailer at Eagle Point Mobile Home Park in Covington, Georgia. Outside the trailer, Chris gave a brief but impassioned statement to a reporter.
But I want my kid back, man. That's my child, man. I want my kid, man.
They spent the night at the home of Courtney's cousin, Craig Weatherford, and his girlfriend. The following morning, on Sunday, October 8, 2017, Courtney received a visit at Craig's house from her mother, Pamela Hamby, with whom she hadn't spoken for about a year prior to Kalia's disappearance. Courtney and Chris went with Pam to her home in Riverside, where Courtney fixed her hair and makeup in preparation for a news interview with Channel 2, during which the intent was to plead with the kidnapper to return Kalia to her parents. The group left Pam's house in the car belonging to and driven by a woman named Lauren Mackey, who was the girlfriend of one of Pam's sons and Courtney's brothers. Pam sat in the passenger seat, while Chris and Courtney sat in the back seat next to Lauren's toddler son. On their way back to Eagle Point Mobile Home Park from Riverside, Courtney received a message on her cell phone from her cousin, Craig. Almost simultaneously, she received a phone call from her Aunt Kim, Craig's mother. While no one involved remembers exactly what was said during that phone call, no one disputes that during that call, Kim managed to convey to Courtney that Kalia had been located. According to pretty much everyone present when this fact was disclosed, the car erupted into chaos, with everyone screaming and otherwise freaking out. Accounts vary as to whether or not Courtney had said aloud that Kalia was dead. Courtney later told police that at the moment Kim told her Kalia had been found, she felt a rush of hope that her daughter may be alive. Chris's reaction was very different, and to many, it was a surefire sign of his guilt. At about 4 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, while Courtney was allegedly preparing for her news appearance, a search party composed of concerned locals happened upon a red and blue Nike Jordan drawstring bag hidden in a shallow depression beneath a log in the woods only 250 yards northeast of the trailer on Lot 31. Inside the drawstring bag was a light blue baby blanket, a gray men's wife-beater tank top, and a few other cloth items. Also inside the bag was the body of a two-week-old baby girl. The search for Kalia Claire Noella McNabb was over. Kalia's body was taken into custody by Newton County Coroner Tommy Davis, who would transport the baby for autopsy to the Georgia Bureau of Investigation headquarters in DeKalb County. News travels fast, especially in small, tight-knit rural communities. As soon as Kim Weatherford found out that her great-niece's body had been discovered, she immediately dialed Courtney's phone number. When Courtney received Kim's phone call, Lauren's car was approaching the red light at the intersection of Covington Bypass and Highway 36 next to the Marathon gas station. Although no one in the car later seemed sure whether or not Chris McNabb had been told at the time that his daughter was dead, one undisputed fact was that the rear passenger side door was opened, Chris exited the vehicle and fled on foot, and subsequently disappeared into a nearby wooded area. Needless to say, the Channel 2 news interview would not take place. Instead, Lauren drove to the Newton County Sheriff's Office, where Courtney was interviewed by investigators Jeff Alexander and Wade Freeman of the Criminal Investigation Division. Investigator Alexander had interviewed both Courtney and Chris the day before, but the information revealed in Sunday's interview would have a much different tone than Saturday's. Because the interview recordings are difficult to understand, I'll quote directly from the transcripts. Before Investigator Alexander entered the room, Courtney told Investigator Freeman,
"He's got a phone with him. Y'all could locate him by it. It's a track phone. I think that it went dead. It has no minutes, but I think it has data."
Courtney also admitted to Investigator Freeman,
"I really believed someone came into my home and took my baby because of all the people in and out of there that I was definitely trying to put a stop to. I lied to y'all yesterday when I said he hadn't hit me. I have bruises on my back and sides. I have had bruises everywhere, all over my arms and legs. I still do."
When asked when Chris hit her, Courtney said,
"He hits me all the time."
The last time he hit her, she said, was Thursday, October 5th, while the couple's children, Kalia and her two-year-old sister, who I'll call Cece, were still with their grandfather, Tim Bell, and their great-grandparents, Jack and Barbara Bell. It was around 7 a.m., and Chris was attempting to leave the house despite Courtney's pleas for him to stay. She said they were sitting on the couch, and he hit her on the side or back of her head after pushing something over or kicking a table, and then he stormed out. She followed him out the door and argued with him for 5 to 10 minutes about going with him. Courtney tried to get into the car he was getting into, but Chris pushed her down in the driveway, causing some injuries to her hands, which she had apparently told the investigators on Saturday occurred during a fight she had with a romantic rival named Danielle. At this point, Investigator Alexander entered the room, and for clarification, Investigator Freeman explained to him,
She started off by telling me she had lied about the fact that he hits her and beats her.
Courtney said,
And everybody knew that, and I tried to defend him against myself, but I never thought he'd hurt the baby. I never imagined that. He was good with them. I don't understand. I just saw something in his eyes when Kalia was born because he didn't get to see that with Cece, and I could see the change in how he felt as a father. I don't understand.
As discussed in Part 1, Chris was in prison during the first year and a half of their older daughter's life, so he wasn't able to bond with her until she was a toddler. From there, Courtney jumped back into her story about the moment she found out Kalia had been found.
So I got some messages on Facebook from Craig and Brianna also. Brianna's first, and she was calling, and then she said they found her. And then I seen Craig's, and he was just calling, and then he said they found the baby, and I had some kind of hope. And so when I said that they found her, Chris started acting crazy, talking about he was going to jail and they're going to think he did this. I'm like, how do you know she's not still alive? And he jumped out. They're going to think I did this, I gotta go. And the phone that he has, he took with him.
Courtney filled in a detail she had missed.
I called my Aunt Kim. I forgot this part. I called my Aunt Kim and I asked her where my baby was. And she just kept putting it off and putting it off. And I had her on speaker and I said, is my baby alive? And Lauren's screaming. I think my mama was saying something, but the car was chaotic. I asked her, is my baby alive, a couple times, and she finally answered me and said, what do you think? She was on the side of the road all night and they found her in a backpack. But I'm not sure if he was still in the car when she said that.
Freeman wanted to confirm a specific detail, asking if Chris had by that point already made the statement,
they're going to think I did this.
Courtney affirmed that, adding,
that's why yesterday I looked at him in his eyes and I asked him, as a mama, I just have to ask you this, did you do this? Did something happen to her and you're trying to cover this up? Did you do this? And we promised each other it was not us, and I knew something's funny when he said, I know damn well Courtney didn't do it because she was asleep, but I didn't do it either, is what comment he made yesterday, I think, to me and Craig.
When Chris was ranting in the car about being suspected of Kalia's death, Freeman asked,
Did you ask him did he do it?
Courtney responded,
No, I was scared of his answer, and I wanted him to get out. I didn't want him beside me no more.
The investigators asked Courtney to describe any backpacks or book bags Chris owned, and in addition to a black zip-up backpack, she said,
The other is a drawstring bag where it's blue on front with a red Jordan symbol, I believe, and then red on the other side with a blue symbol. It's the opposite, you know?
She had just described the exact bag in which her daughter's body had been discovered, confirming it was, indeed, Chris McNabb's bag. Courtney begged the investigators for more information, but they explained that although they wanted to tell her everything they knew to give her comfort, for the integrity of the investigation, and in the interest of finding justice for Kalia, they had to hold back some of the information for the time being. Courtney asked,
So she is not alive? She's not alive?
Investigator Alexander replied,
No.
Courtney said,
This is unreal, and I thought my stillborn was so hard.
Also during the interview, Investigator Freeman said,
I'm not accusing you in any way, but I just want to make sure you understand that, just like you lied to us about him hitting on you, if there's anything else that you need to tell,
Courtney interrupted with,
We use drugs, but that don't make me a bad mama. I made sure my babies were okay.
She told the investigators that she used weed and meth. Of the two of them, she said, she had been clean the longest, but then,
He cheated on me. He kept talking to another female, and I was put through so much, and he hit on me. I'm so weak. But I made sure my babies were okay.
That morning, she told them, her cousin Craig told her he had a bad feeling about Chris. Saying all Chris kept saying the night before
was that he just wanted to die, he just wanted to kill himself.
She also said that when they returned to the trailer after the previous day's police interviews, Chris had become angry and punched the wall.
I mean, he just tried to make a big old scene, like he couldn't cry, but he still had that anger.
Freeman asked,
Did he tend to hit things a lot, like you said he hit the wall?
Courtney answered,
Yeah, or throw things, or bust things, or break things, yeah.
She said, however, that Chris never hit the kids and didn't even believe in whoopings. Clearly suspicious of Chris, Courtney said her cousin Craig had also pointed out that while Chris was supposed to be sleeping, at 5-something on Saturday morning, he updated his Facebook profile picture. Another tidbit no one had mentioned to the investigators the day before was that one reason Courtney and Chris had been sleeping on the couch was so they could have sex, which they didn't want to do in the bedroom with the kids there. She didn't say whose idea this was, but keep in mind that Courtney had given birth 2 weeks before. Most doctors recommend waiting 4 to 6 weeks after childbirth to resume sexual activity because having sex too soon after giving birth can increase the risk of infection in the uterus or even hemorrhage. Anyway, after their romantic interlude, while Courtney was in the bathroom, she heard the baby wake up and went to help Chris quiet her down. After that, she put Empire on TV and fell asleep while Chris was still tending to the baby in the back bedroom. During the interview, Courtney also told police that Chris was responsible for the brown men's shoes, a camouflage jacket, and a hookah pipe that were found in the woods near the location where Kalia's body was ultimately found. She said the items belonged to Matt Lester, the man Chris told investigators he had beaten up a few weeks before when he suspected Matt of breaking into their home. One of the last statements Courtney made to police during that interview was one of her most poignant.
"Thank y'all for finding my baby. I'm sorry that it was this way. Please find out what happened to her."
Meanwhile, Chris McNabb spent a few hours slogging around in the woods in the rain, getting soaked, filthy, and covered with burrs. At around 7 p.m., Chris entered a Chevron food mart on Highway 36, purchased a Pepsi, and ranted and raved to everyone in the building that he didn't do it, that he wasn't responsible for his daughter's death, and that they would be surprised when they found out what really happened. As soon as he left the store, several people called 911 to report the sighting, because police had announced earlier that day that there was a warrant for Chris's arrest on a probation violation.
"That guy that his baby was found dead is in the Chevron on 36.
Highway 36, I'm at the food mart, the Chevron food mart. The guy that his daughter was found or whatever this morning is walking up the road up here."
Okay, where is he walking?
He just turned, he walked out of the gas station, the Chevron gas station, down towards 213 through the car wash.
"Yes, the guy y'all are looking for, he's in the store right here at 36. And, 213 at the food mart. He just walked
36 and 213?
Yes.
Is it a Chevron right there?
Is there what?
Is that a Chevron right there?
Yeah, he's checking out at the thing. He's got a white hat, black shirt, tattoos all over his face.
Okay, hold on one second.
He's coming out the door.
Okay, just keep me updated, okay, on what he's doing.
Okay. He's arguing with some people.
What kind of car is he in?
He's walking, ma'am. Now he's going. He's at him.
He's walking.
He's going.
Okay, then.
Now he's taking off.
As he left the Chevron and walked across the adjacent car wash parking lot, Chris was arrested by Newton County Sheriff's officers without incident. He was booked into Newton County Jail on a probation violation warrant out of Bartow County. At this point, he was only considered a person of interest in Kalia's murder, not an official suspect. Prior to taking up residence in a cell downstairs, Chris also submitted to a second interview by investigators Alexander and Freeman. They took his wet, muddy clothes into evidence, gave him a jail jumpsuit and flip-flops to wear, and once again informed him of his Miranda rights, having him sign another waiver. Chris said he found out that Kalia had been found when Aunt Kim called Courtney in the car.
"I think it's her Aunt Kim called, and she had her on speakerphone, and she was like, they found her, and said that she had passed away. They said that she was located on the side of the road and that she was dead and that I done it. That was what the lady said. Her exact words was, Chris done it, Chris done it. She was found on the side of the road."
He said he jumped out of the car because he felt like all eyes were on him, that he was being gunned for, and that he was the one everyone thought had committed the crime.
"I mean, I felt like all the eyes were on me as the suspect. I felt like I was the one who everybody thought done it. Everything that's being said on Facebook, everything that's being said amongst people in real life, most people think I had something to do with it."
Chris, who claimed he remembered nothing from the day before due to
shock, I guess,
admitted when asked by investigator Alexander that he did drugs every day, including that very day. Alexander asked what drug he did today, and Chris immediately responded,
"Meth."
Alexander asked if he did meth Friday night, to which Chris replied,
"I do meth every night."
Sounds like a healthy self-care regimen. Interestingly, Chris continued to deny Courtney's use of meth, unaware that Courtney herself had admitted to it during her interview. Alexander asked why Courtney would say she did meth, and Chris said,
"If she done it, I didn't know about it."
After hearing bits and pieces of Courtney's story about the morning of Kalia's disappearance, Chris gave a similar story. He said he'd been wearing the same clothes for about 4 or 5 days prior to showering on the night of the 6th or in the early morning hours of the 7th. Remember, they did not have laundry facilities inside the mobile home. After his shower, he said, he didn't put on a shirt. He was wearing green camouflage boxers and blue sweatpants. He did some meth, but he said Courtney hadn't, even though she told investigators they did meth together that night. He said after that, they smoked a piece of a joint and had sex. He cleaned up on the couch while she cleaned up in the bathroom. It was then that the baby woke up, so he went and picked up Kalia. Courtney told him not to feed her in the living room because of the smoke, so he took the baby out on the front porch to begin feeding her. He brought her back inside and finished feeding her while sitting on the bed. Then they changed her diaper together. After feeding her, Chris burped her, then swaddled her in her blanket and put her in her rock and play. Part of that statement may or may not have been what's known as leakage, which is basically a slip of the tongue in which a subject reveals information unintentionally. Chris said he placed Kalia's pacifier on top of her, and Alexander asked if he put it in the baby's mouth. Chris's reply was,
"No, I put it on top of her body because she was already asleep. She didn't need it."
I wonder if investigators found it odd in hindsight that Chris referred to the placement as on top of her body rather than on her chest or something that more readily conveyed a live baby as opposed to a dead one. Anyway, Chris told the investigators that he then went to the living room and, noticing Courtney was falling asleep, took her cigarette out of her hand. Not one to waste, of course, he took a couple hits off the smoke, put it out, and fell asleep on the couch with Courtney. He woke up at 9:30 to a text from his dad, and at that point, he was cold, so he went to the bedroom and grabbed a blanket off the bed to cover himself and Courtney. He noticed then that both girls were present and sleeping. Kalia, he said, was still
snug as a bug in a rug.
He then returned to the living room, covered himself and Courtney with the blanket, and went back to sleep. The next thing he knew, Chris said, he was being awakened by Cece, who he described as
freaking out, crying a little bit, acting a little strange, backing up into the corner like I said.
Alexander asked if anything had happened while Chris was changing or feeding Kalia, such as dropping her, but Chris said he had never dropped the baby. He also said Cece had never dropped her, to his recollection, and that the worst he'd ever seen her do was pick the baby up upside down and hold her up for a second before he grabbed Kalia. Freeman asked,
"When you came in there after feeding the baby and Courtney was on the couch falling asleep, did you go right to sleep too, or did you sit there on—"
Chris interrupted.
"I mean, I took the cigarette from her. I hit it a couple times, I put it out, and I laid on her leg and went to sleep."
Freeman pressed,
"You didn't sit there and get on your phone and stuff like that?"
Chris replied,
"No, sir."
Freeman then asked if anyone else had access to Chris's Facebook account, which Chris denied, saying he didn't think so. He told them he had multiple Facebook accounts but didn't access them all. He explained he had created the Jordan Headcrack Izzy account early on the morning of the 7th, sometime between 12 and 3 a.m., he thought, because he was unable to access his usual account, Jordan Headcrack Izzo. He told them he created the new profile, added a profile picture, and then abandoned the account because he was able to recover the password to his other one. When asked about the time, he reiterated that he thought it was between 12 and 3, but he said,
"I know Courtney was still awake when I done it."
The investigators confronted him about the profile picture marked as posted at 5:34 a.m., and he basically shrugged it off, saying,
"I don't remember every single little detail of everything. All I know is that I didn't goddamn kill my little girl, man."
Kalia's autopsy was conducted on the morning of Monday, October 9, 2017, at the Georgia Bureau of Investigation's Medical Examiner's Office. When the results came back the following day, Newton County Coroner Tommy Davis announced that the baby's death was a homicide caused by blunt force head trauma. After these findings, the Newton County Sheriff's Office issued multiple warrants for Christopher McNabb, alleging Chris hit Kalia with an unknown object. The warrant said,
"This action did cause the victim's skull to be seriously disfigured and damaged beyond repair. This act further caused the death of the victim."
The skull of a newborn baby is flexible due to the bony plates that make up the skull not being fused together with bone. Instead, they are joined by a tough membrane that eventually hardens into bone. This allows the baby's head to change shape enough to pass through the birth canal. Kalia had suffered fractures of her individual skull plates, but also to the membranes connecting them, causing one of the plates to be punched in. She also suffered an incised wound beneath one eye, a bruise on her left cheek and along her jawline, and lacerations of the membranes of her mouth, including the tissue connecting her upper lip and gums, as well as her upper palate. It would later be revealed that Kalia's injuries were so severe that her deciduous baby teeth had erupted from her upper gums. On October 11th, Chris was served with the warrants in Newton County Jail and charged with malice murder, felony murder, aggravated battery, and concealing the death of another. His charges would still need to be indicted by the grand jury of Newton County, which seemed like a formality at that point. The following day, Chris appeared before Judge Melanie Bell in the courtroom located at the Newton County Jail, dressed in an orange jail jumpsuit with his wrists shackled to his waist. He kept his head down for the entire proceeding, his hair hanging in his eyes, barely speaking a word and only mumbling when he did. At that hearing, Chris was, of course, denied bond. J.C. Harwell and Son Funeral Home and Cremation Chapel in Covington donated its services to ensure Kalia had a proper burial. A vault company donated the casket for the baby's burial, and the funeral home held a private service for her family. She was buried in a church cemetery nearby. In mid-October, someone removed the memorial to Kalia that had been placed in the woods near the body discovery site, but the heartbroken community came together to build a new one, including a wooden cross. In December of 2017, Chris McNabb requested another interview with investigators, saying he had information about his child's death. The 2.5-hour interview was conducted by investigator Jeff Alexander on December 13th and came about after a phone call between Chris and Courtney on December 11th, which would later be played at trial. During the December interview, after being Mirandized yet again, Chris attempted to lay the blame for Kalia's death on family friend Jeremy Shane Kidd, who had supposedly told someone who told someone who told someone that someone important put out a hit on Chris, and Shane went to the trailer to do it, but something went wrong, and Kalia died instead. Yeah, because someone who breaks into a trailer home in broad daylight to commit murder could totally mistake a 2-week-old premature infant for a fully grown man with tattoos all over his face. Seems legit. Chris said during the interview,
I know deep down inside that when it's all said and done, that methamphetamine is going to be the reason why my child ended up dead. Because it was somebody that was coming around, and everybody that was coming around because of methamphetamine.
During this interview, he admitted that the reason Courtney left the kids with Megan on October 1st was to chase him around and find out where he was, because she wanted to be with him. They still had the car at the time, and Courtney was driving around looking for him. Tuesday morning, he told her where he was, so she picked him up. He said they were just about to go pick up the kids from Megan when Jack, Tim, and Barbara pulled up and took the car. Chris told investigator Alexander that he had a special bond with Kalia. If she was crying, he said, all he had to do was rub her forehead and she would stop. The second she was born, when he started rubbing her forehead, she stopped crying. He loved having that bond with her because he couldn't have it with Cece due to his imprisonment around the time of her birth in 2015. Chris also told investigator Alexander that Courtney was back on drugs.
Somebody needs to talk to Courtney because she's scared, Mr. Alexander. She's scared that somebody's going to do her the way I'm being done, I guess. She don't want to be locked up, but she's also hurting so bad that she feels like the only way to escape is by being high.
Only at this point did Chris finally display the first hint of willingness to throw Courtney under the bus, saying,
If you feel like you need to question her about maybe you think there's a possibility she did it, then by all means you're going to do what you're going to do. But I know that I didn't do it because I know what I'd done that day and that night. I remember what I'd done. I know I didn't do it. And I can't go as far as saying that I know for 100% solid fact that she didn't do it because I was asleep.
Chris said he didn't get involved in any search party looking for Kalia because Courtney's Aunt Kim had told him if he was the one who found her, it wouldn't look good. He said after he heard about the baby and jumped out of the car, he was in the woods and threw his phone on the ground in case they were tracking it, and he told Alexander they might want to go find it. He talked about how he ultimately came out of hiding, went into the Chevron, and told everyone in the store that he didn't do it, saying his main intent was to spur someone to call the police, which they did.
I didn't try to run. I got on the ground. I didn't have a death wish.
Chris also confirmed that the red and blue drawstring bag in which Kalia was found was his, saying he used to carry it around all the time, containing things like a change of clothes or drug paraphernalia. He said the bag had most likely been in one of the bins with his clothes, which was, he surmised, where the killer found it. By this time, he and Courtney were no longer together, which probably explained why he was willing to insinuate that she might be responsible for their daughter's murder.
She's doing whatever she can to get by, and that means using these dudes for places to live, to get high, or whatever she's doing.
Still, he had no doubts both girls were biologically his, and that Courtney never cheated on him during their relationship. I guess that privilege was reserved just for him. In the interview, Chris also denied killing Kalia.
My lawyer told me that her brains came out of her head. Could you imagine? Can you imagine that? I can't even imagine it. I can't see anybody wanting to do something like that, especially not me. That's sick, man. That's fucked up, man. That's brutal, dude. Whoever did it ain't got a heart, man. But I've got a heart. Man, I miss my kids. I miss my life. I miss my family. I'm sorry.
Just throwing this out there, an apology given in a statement can also be a sign of leakage. On December 21, 2017, Courtney Bell was arrested for criminal trespass after being caught breaking into a home with Joshua Epperson, who she had been living with. Rockdale County Sheriff's Officer Shane Ballard responded to a burglary in progress on Philadelphia Road in Conyers, and when he approached the front door, he heard a noise from inside the home. While he searched the inside of the residence, according to the Covington News, deputies detained the two suspects on their knees in the front yard. Josh was wanted in Newton County, as it turned out, but Courtney bonded out of the Rockdale County Jail on December 26th. Nothing like spending Christmas in jail to boost your holiday spirit. Well, the festivities weren't over for Courtney. On January 5th, 2018, the Newton County Grand Jury convened, and not only was Christopher McNabb finally indicted on his murder charges, but Courtney herself was also indicted on felony charges of murder in the second degree, cruelty to children, and deprivation of a minor. The following day, she was arrested in the parking lot of Home Depot in Conyers. She was held without bail in the Newton County Jail, and on January 7th, she was interviewed yet again by investigator Jeff Alexander. Every story I tell needs a hero, and although there were several, investigator Alexander is definitely the main protagonist in Kalia's story. Courtney was perplexed by her murder charge and asked investigator Alexander to explain her charges.
So why am I being charged with murder?
Well, because the DA's office has decided you'd be actually being charged with murder in the second degree.
It's still murder, and I didn't do this, and it had nothing to do with any of it. I didn't even know about it.
There is, do you know the other charges you're being charged with also?
Yeah.
Okay. The
cruelty to children in second degree, and then that one I don't know what it means.
That's contributing to the deprivation of a child. It basically means that because of the improper care and things that have been going on in the household.
That's the only thing that I should be charged with.
Well, and that's something that you and your attorney and the prosecutor's office will have to talk about, okay? One of the things that...
And I've already, we talked about that, and I agreed to that.
Who talked about what?
I mean, when we first spoke, I told you that I had been... I was completely honest. I told y'all what all went on and what all happened and what all we did. And I am guilty of somewhat neglect because I did drugs. But I never see this coming. This is my baby. I went to fucking sleep and I woke up and she's gone. This just drove me crazy every goddamn day.
And how have you dealt with it?
I self-medicate.
You're doing what?
Drugs. But for the last week, I ain't even had a taste for drugs. I want help. I had drugs on me yesterday, but I hadn't even done any. I went to sleep the night before, and I woke up 2 hours prior to being arrested. Had drugs on me, didn't want the drugs, didn't do any of them.
Other than that night, you went to sleep the night before, when was the last time you slept or ate bread?
I have to think for a minute. I just woke up.
It's been that long, huh?
No, it's not been that long. It's a lot of things go on in my life.
Mm-hmm. Like what?
Like me not having anywhere to go. Mm-hmm. Because of all this. My mom was took from me. My family was took from me. My car was took from me.
Courtney told the investigator that she had nowhere to stay because she wasn't allowed to be with Cece, who was at that time living with Courtney's father, Tim, and her grandparents. She hadn't seen Cece in over a month, she said, although she talked to her daughter every day.
I wish I could have went home. That's what I needed, was my family. But I don't deserve them at all. I'm hurting every single fucking second of the day. For Cece and for Kalia. Cece hardly even talks anymore. She ain't the same little girl, and it hurts so bad.
She told investigator Alexander that she went to Kalia's grave all the time to talk to her. Kalia was buried behind a church on Almond Road, where Courtney's nanny had two burial plots. She hadn't been to visit the grave lately, however, because she didn't have a vehicle. Also during the interview, Courtney said a girl, Christy, had told her she heard from her roommate, Sierra, that someone important had put a hit out on Chris. When Courtney went and talked to Sierra about it, Sierra said no, Shane Kidd had only said that he had gotten caught up in all this, and it was all on Courtney and Chris. Courtney must have told Chris this story on the phone in December, which was why Chris brought it up in his third interview. Both Chris McNabb and Courtney Bell were arraigned on their charges on January 23, 2018. In May of the same year, Chris filed a motion attempting to suppress the statements he gave to police. The motion was denied on the grounds that he was properly Mirandized and treated very well, even asked if he needed a drink. At that point, the trial was scheduled to begin in August, but it was postponed. On June 19, 2018, Courtney's paternal grandmother, Barbara Jean Bell, who raised her and was part of the trio who tried to save little Cece and Kalia by removing them from the trailer of horrors in early October of 2017, passed away at the age of 76. Barbara's obituary states that she was preceded in death by her sons, Tony and Tommy Bell, her daughter, Donna Jean Turpin, and her great-granddaughter, Kalia Bell. At that point, the family was doing its very best to scrub out the stain the McNabb name had left on them. In July of 2018, the prosecution filed a motion to join Chris's and Courtney's trials, which Alcove Judicial Circuit Chief Judge John M. Ott approved. In my opinion, Judge Ott is another hero in this story, and after you hear parts of the trial, I think you'll agree. Finally, in March of 2019, the joint trial for 29-year-old Christopher Michael McNabb and 26-year-old Courtney Marie Bell was scheduled to begin in May. Judge Ott ruled that jurors at the trial would not hear of the couple's prior arrests, but evidence of their drug use and history of domestic violence would be admissible. Their defense attorneys moved to have the trial moved out of Newton County because of pretrial publicity, but that motion was also denied. A motion to allow news cameras in the courtroom was approved, so the trial was fully live-streamed and is still viewable on both YouTube and Court TV. The trial of her parents for the murder of Kalia McNabb began on May 7, 2019. By this time, Courtney had put on a significant amount of weight. She had also entered a motion for reasonable cosmetic accommodations, but she appeared in court without makeup, her brown hair tinged with faded pink at the tips. Chris, wearing black glasses and a suit, had gussied himself up with some new face tattoos by that time, including Kalia's name inked over his left eyebrow. Pardon me for being a tad bit cynical about his motivation for doing that. The case was prosecuted by Alcove Judicial Circuit District Attorney Layla Zahn and Assistant District Attorney Alexandra, or Alex, Stone. Alex Stone gave the opening argument for the prosecution.
On September 23rd, 2017, at 9:53 p.m., Kalia Claire McNabb came into this world weighing 6 pounds and 6 ounces. She was a little premature, but otherwise a healthy baby. The evidence will show that just 14 days later, her father, Christopher Michael McNabb, ended her life so abruptly and with such force that her baby teeth came through her gums and into her tongue. You'll hear that she was then later left out in the woods, wrapped in clothes and a blanket. She was stuffed into a bag. She was put under a log, in a hole, and left out for strangers to find. The evidence will also show that Courtney Bell was too busy smoking methamphetamine to protect her child. I expect that throughout this trial, there's gonna be some people that you don't like. You're going to see that Chris and Courtney weren't living the most savory lifestyle. They were surrounding the people that they were around are not going to be people that most people would have a 14-day-old baby around. But we're not going to sugarcoat anything for you. We're going to show you exactly how this baby was living. Today is the day that you hear the case against Christopher McNabb and Courtney Bell. But it's also the case that you're also the day that you're hearing the case of Kalia Claire McNabb.
Chris's attorney, Anthony Carter, gave his opening statement in which he insinuated his client wasn't the sharpest crayon in the box. I actually burst out laughing during this opening statement, which I have to admit is a rarity during most of my research.
Christopher McNabb had absolutely nothing to do with the disappearance and death of his daughter, Kalia. You're going to hear evidence today about physical altercations between Christopher McNabb and Courtney Bell. And you're going to hear evidence that they and their friends used drugs. I expect that the state is going to rely heavily on these two facts to try to convince you that Christopher McNabb killed his daughter on October 7th. But what happened in the first 48 hours of this case is the police determined that their suspect was going to be somebody close to the child. Certainly, Chris McNabb and Courtney Bell are the closest one to the child. And they focused like a laser on Christopher McNabb as being the person who killed his daughter. In fact, they developed their whole case around the supposition and the hypothesis that Christopher McNabb is the one who killed his daughter. And you know why they did that. You know, look at him. Look at the way he looks. Look at the fact that he had physical altercations with Courtney. Look at the fact that they did do drugs. Of course they're going to look at him. When a pack of lions go after a herd of gazelle, they don't go after the smartest gazelle. They don't go after the fastest gazelle. They go after the gazelle that is vulnerable, the gazelle that's hurt, the gazelle that's not as smart as the others. And that's what the police did in this case. They went after the people who were most vulnerable in this case, the people who had just lost their two-week-old daughter.
Defense attorney Brian Frost gave the opening statement for Courtney, which was just boring enough not to warrant inclusion in this podcast. His statement in a nutshell was that Courtney didn't do it. On day one of the trial, Courtney's 911 call was played, during which Chris wiped away tears. Next, Courtney's father, Tim Bell, testified, talking about taking the kids in the days leading up to Kalia's murder and describing how his daughter fell under the spell of an abusive, drug-addicted criminal.
Now, did you approve of your daughter's relationship with Mr. McNabb?
No.
Why were you taking, I understand why you were taking your kids back. Why were you taking the car back?
Because they was doing them old heavy drug things, you know, and she wasn't doing what she was supposed to do with the car.
Okay, and when you say heavy drugs, what drugs were you aware that she was using?
That methamphetamines.
Were you concerned for your grandchildren's welfare that day?
Yes, ma'am.
Did y'all ever reach an agreement about what was going to happen with the children?
Yes, the deputy told Courtney to let my sister come get and bring her to me.
So did you do that?
Yes.
Was there any discussion at that time about getting the car back to him?
Oh, yes.
What was that discussion?
He was in the background hollering. He was wanting to trade the car back for the kids.
Okay. So
trade the kids back for the car, brother.
So they wanted the car and you could keep the kids?
That's right. I took the babies home that Friday after I told Courtney that she needed to clean the house up and get the house in order before I would bring the babies back.
Right.
Okay.
So you said that the baby was born again on what day?
23rd September.
And we were just talking that it was on October the 3rd that you called 911, right?
Yes, I guess, yes.
And you said it was when that Courtney came to see you 2 days later?
Yeah, on Thursday.
All right. So that would have been, what, 10-5?
Okay. I took Courtney back home that Thursday.
Okay.
I went and got her that Thursday morning and took her back home that Thursday afternoon.
Okay.
Okay. Then I brought the babies back to Courtney that Friday at lunchtime.
Okay. Okay. And that would have been on October the 6th. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And was Chris there too?
Yes, he was hiding behind a tree.
Was it fair to say that the trailer was kind of a mess?
Yes.
Was it an environment or in the condition that you would want it to be in for your two granddaughters to
no.
be raised in?
No.
And you said you told them to clean it up and...
Told Courtney.
Was that a condition of you bringing the children back?
That's right, yes, ma'am.
When you got there, did she have it cleaned?
Yes, ma'am. You know, the kitchen and the living room and the hallways...
Picked up?
Yes. Picked up and put in totes, plastic totes and stuff.
Now, do you remember about what time it was on October the 6th that you brought the babies back?
Yeah, it was lunchtime, around 12, 1, somewhere in that area.
And when you brought them back, were there supplies for the babies?
Yes, I brought them. I brought milk and diapers for both babies.
Was baby Kalia healthy when you brought her back that day?
Yes, ma'am.
Was baby Kalia... clean when you brought her back that day?
Yes, ma'am.
Was she fed?
Yes, ma'am.
Was she dressed up and something
yes,
to
ma'am.
Wear? Did you see her after you dropped her off that day?
No, not. I've never seen the baby after Friday.
Following Tim's testimony, Courtney's cousin, Megan Sorrells, took the stand, describing how she worried for the girls amidst the chaos in the McNabb trailer. She told the court about how she called her mom to vent when she became overwhelmed caring for Courtney's two kids in addition to her own four.
Why was it that you regretted calling Tim?
Because I feel like it stirred up everything. I've blamed myself the whole time. Like, maybe if I would have just dealt with it a different way, or I don't know. I just feel like I made that phone call that day to my mom and Kim Weatherford, and when she called her brother Tim Bell, everything got out of control, and I blamed myself the whole time.
Megan said she had seen signs of abuse on her cousin.
Would you say that your cousin had some things going on at that period of time?
Yes, sir.
Was there some violence going on between?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Between who?
Courtney and Chris.
Did she have any bruising visible that day?
Yes, she always had bruises on her.
Did you ever discuss that with her?
We have a few times. I've confronted her about it a few times, but I mean, I went through abuse myself, so I didn't really have to ask me any questions. I could tell.
Also on day one of the trial, Newton County Sheriff's Officer Joshua Hicks took the stand, describing Courtney's demeanor when officers responded to her 911 call.
What was her demeanor when you first arrived?
I would say sporadic.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
Like, and she would be calm, collected, and then as she began describing what happened to the child, she'd start to panic a little bit, and then she would go right back down to being calm, collected.
Chris, Officer Hicks said, was fidgety.
And when you first made contact with him, I guess, what did you notice about him?
He was wet. He had, looked like green stuff you might get from walking through the woods, and he was extremely nervous.
I guess you said that he was nervous. Can you describe his demeanor?
Fidgety, like going in and out of his pockets, looking left, looking right.
Next up was NCSO Deputy Raymond Walden, who was the first officer Chris spoke to on the morning of October 7th when he emerged from the woods.
When he first walked up to me, he was not excited or anything. He just walked up to me and looked at me, and I noticed he was soaking wet. And his feet was muddy, and I said, "Where you been?" And he said he would left the trailer and went into the woods. I said, "Why did you go in the woods looking for a two-week-old child?" He said, I was just looking.
Day one was packed with testimony, finishing up with search volunteers, including Tara Robinson, who found the drawstring bag containing Kalia's body.
And under the log was a pile of sticks and twigs up underneath it. I had picked up one of the sticks and began to move away some of the leaves, and that's when I saw the black string.
And did you do anything about that black string?
I took the stick and I pulled it up to see what it was, and it was a bag. And that's when I told one of the children to go get the officer.
On Wednesday, May 8th, Melissa Missy Davis testified about her relationship with Courtney and Chris and the chaotic environment she entered when she arrived at the trailer on the morning of October 7th, 2017.
So I walked up there with my grandson, and Chris was on the porch screaming, "They're going to think I did this. They're going to think I did it." He was hysterical. And I went up to him, and I said, "Chris, calm down. What's going on?" And he just kept screaming, "They're going to think I did this." I told him to calm down and let's figure out what's going on. He said, "The baby's gone."
Okay.
And I walked in the living room, and he walked with me, and I grabbed his hands and told him to calm down.
Okay. And what happened after that?
He left. And I asked Courtney if she called the police yet, and she said no. And I just felt like something wasn't right, and I had my grandson, so I told my grandson to run, and I left.
Okay. I guess, what was Courtney's demeanor during all of this interaction that you had?
She was calling out Kylie's name, or Kalia's name.
Okay.
And while she's on the phone, you know, looking up in her clothes and stuff.
NCSO Crime Scene Investigator Corporal Mickey Kitchens took the stand next, and his testimony took most of the morning. Corporal Kitchens said that because of the number of people in and out of the trailer on the day of Kalia's disappearance, including family members, friends, and law enforcement, pretty much all of the evidence in the home was considered compromised.
With the use of so many people going in and out of the trailer, as I explained before, every time someone comes in or leaves, they change the dynamics. With so many people coming in, searching, moving stuff around, it's going to compromise any evidence that would have been there. Any fingerprints that might would have been there would have already been disturbed, have been rendered useless, unidentifiable. Any kind of DNA would have been not been useful because there had been so many different profiles already added to whatever was already there, simply because of so many people coming in and out.
Next, Courtney's aunt, Kim Weatherford, testified. Kim, who is the mother of Courtney's cousins, Megan Sorrells and Craig Weatherford, told the court that she felt from the beginning that Chris had killed Kalia.
When you were on the phone with Courtney, your husband called and Craig was texting. At some point during that conversation, you said Chris did it, something of that nature. You said you thought Chris may have done it. Is that fair?
That was my feeling from the get-go.
Next on the stand was Courtney's mother, Pamela Hamby, who struggled under questioning to explain why Chris jumped out of the car.
Just everybody just freaked out, kind of started screaming this and that, but I can't remember exactly what was said.
What did Chris do?
He got out of the car.
And where was that at?
At the red light.
Did you help him get out of the car?
I can't remember. I told him to get out of the car because I was afraid that guns were going to be put on the car and my grandbaby was in there.
Okay, and why would you tell him to get, why would you think that there were going to be guns put on the car?
I didn't know who was responsible for what had happened. You know, just thinking that he, you know, somebody might have done something wrong that, you know, one of them maybe had done something wrong and the guns were going to be drawn. I just was thinking about my grandbaby. I didn't want my grandbaby to be in the middle of that.
The final witness of the day was Georgia Bureau of Investigation Medical Examiner Dr. Laura Darasaw, who conducted Kalia's autopsy. While autopsy photos, which the media had been forbidden from broadcasting, were shown to the court, both Courtney and Chris wept and covered their faces.
What's most notable, the head is enlarged visually. By filling the head, it was very soft, and you could feel there was already broken bones just by palpation of the head. You can see that there are injuries of the face. You can see the eyes are closed, and just underneath the right eye is a cut, this horizontal cut just underneath the eye. This is a 14-day-old infant, so obviously there's no teeth that are erupted in a 14-day-old, but we all have our teeth inside the gums, called deciduous teeth. So in this particular case, the deciduous teeth had come out because of a laceration to the upper gums. So that's the picture just showing the teeth that you can see in the mouth. So just under the ruler with the number is obviously the chin. This is the me pulling up the upper lip. You can see the laceration or the defects in the gum and along the frenulum, the little tag of skin in the center of the lip. And that's where the teeth have come out of, because that's where the deciduous teeth kind of rest up inside the mouth.
And I guess, do you have any idea what could have caused that sort of trauma?
A very hard force to the mouth. And there's a lot of injuries of the head that we can see. And with the huge amount of impact to the head that resulted in all the fractures, that is certainly an injury that could have resulted along with that impact. This is a photograph of the left side of the face. We've seen this bruise on the left side of the jawline before, but this is just kind of showing that again. But it's also showing just the entire profile of the head, and you can see, I mean, it's obviously not the normal shape of an infant of this age. It's elongated. So this is a photograph of the reflected scalp. You can see the cut line along the skin, which I indicated is from ear to ear. The front portion of the scalp is pulled forward. The back portion is pulled backward. This is the initial cut and reflection. And so in this cut, you can see there's a big hole in the, and that should not be there. That should be the skull all intact. But in this particular instance, there were multiple fractures of the skull. And so some of the pieces of the skull are just held together by what's called the periosteum, which is a very thin layer of soft tissue over the skull. But so basically there's lots of fractures. There's the open defect in the skull from displaced portions of bones being displaced kind of inside that hole. Most of these portions of skull are displaced already, and as I mentioned, they're kind of just held together by thin strands of soft tissue. These are some of the pictures of bones that were essentially displaced, but then individually, too, there are fractures along the fragments. That's a portion of the orbital plate. So the the bones that cover the back of the eyes. So there were orbital plate fractures. As you can see, a portion of the orbital plate has been displaced with this. Two fragments of bone that in each of them there are also linear fractures. Well, the brain was essentially not formed at all. For a 14-day-old child, the brain is formed. It looks like a brain. It's formed like a brain. It has a lot more water content than our brain, so it's a little bit softer, I would say like a jelly mold than our brain, being more firm. But you can see the structures of the brain. It is well-formed. In this case, there was no well-formed brain at all. It was mostly almost liquefied at this point. There was a lot of blood in the skull cavity, and the brain itself was not recognizable as a brain. It was just mostly liquid inside of the skull.
And were you able to determine a cause and manner of death in this case?
Yes, I was.
Okay, and what was that cause of death?
The cause of death was blunt impact injuries of the head.
Okay, what was the manner of death?
The manner of death was certified as homicide.
We talked about the fact that an injury like this could be caused by a series of blows with some object. Is that fair?
That's correct.
It could also be caused by maybe a foot, like a stomping, where one part of a head would be on a hard surface and a foot or some other object crushed her head.
Yeah, we talked about that, it's, you know, it could be very much a crushing injury.
Okay. And if we had other circumstances, it's possible that possibly a television would have fallen on top of her, and you would see injuries like this if that would have happened.
Yeah, I would say with the idea that these injuries could very well be a crushing type of trauma. You know, crushing could come from a heavy object falling on top and crushing the head, or a foot stomping the head, or something like that. Yes, sir.
After Dr. Darasaw's testimony, late in the afternoon, the jury left the courtroom for a field trip of sorts to visit the location where Kalia's body had been discovered. Day 3 of the trial opened with the testimony of Lauren Mackey, who had been driving the car Chris jumped out of on October 8th. Lauren was the girlfriend of one of Courtney's brothers. Lauren struggled to maintain composure on the stand, clearly emotionally affected by the whole experience.
Everybody kind of started yelling. I was yelling, "Where do we go?" They were all yelling at each other. Just a lot of yelling.
What did Chris McNabb do?
They were all freaking out. I don't know specifics because I was trying to get directions to go, know where to go. So I don't know what everybody was saying, but Chris ended up jumping out of the car at the red light.
At that time, did you know whether the baby had been found alive or dead?
No, I had no idea. I thought the baby was alive.
Next on the stand was a woman named Julie Hanna, who was working at the Chevron gas station food mart when Chris McNabb came in after fleeing into the woods.
He was real wet and nasty. I don't mean nasty, nasty. He was just, you know, we'd been running through the woods or whatever. And when he came in, he said, "I've been running." And I said, "Why?" And he goes, "The cops are on my trail or on my heels or something." And he said, "I got out of the car and ran." And I said, "Why?" He said, "That was my baby." And then it dawned on me, he's the guy from the night before. And then I remember what everybody was saying. And
did you call 911?
Yes, I did.
And did he say anything else to you in the store?
He said, "I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I swear I didn't do it." I said, "Well, then you need to tell him." He said, "Y'all are going to be surprised." I said, "I'm not going to be surprised. But if you didn't do it and you know who did, you need to tell it."
Can you describe how he was acting, what his behavior was like?
Kind of hyper.
After Julie's testimony, Catherine Wesley, a customer who witnessed Chris's bizarre outburst in the store, testified about the encounter as well. Next, Courtney's cousin, Craig Weatherford, testified, telling the jury about his drug use with Courtney and Chris the night before Kalia's disappearance.
Kalia went missing on October 7th. Did you see them the day before that?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
And where did you see them at?
Oh, at their trailer off Highway 36.
Do you know what time of day that was?
It was around 8 o'clock, ma'am.
Why?
Morning or night?
It was night, sir. Sorry.
Why did you go over there?
Courtney gave me a call, and I went over there, and we did drugs together. We all smoked a bowl. We smoked meth. I saw Kalia.
Okay, and
Okay, and where was she when you saw her?
She was in the back bedroom in a bassinet.
Okay, and was she okay?
Yes, ma'am. She looked fine. She was sleeping good.
That afternoon, Investigator Jeff Alexander took the stand, where he remained for the better part of 2 days, while hours of footage was played from his interviews with Chris McNabb and Courtney Bell, which I've already gone over at length. Investigator Alexander testified between police interview footage clips. The defense had tried to make a big deal about the police neglecting to consider the trailer a crime scene and doing intensive testing, fingerprinting, and swabbing for DNA. Investigator Alexander explained on the stand that this decision was based on the medical examiner's determination that there would be very little, if any, blood from Kalia's closed head injuries, as well as based on the fact that multiple people were in and out of the crime scene the morning of October 7th when Kalia was considered missing.
When this autopsy was conducted, did you see baby Kalia removed from the body bag?
I did.
Did you observe how she was unwrapped, so to speak?
I did.
And can you tell the members of the jury what you saw the child was wrapped in?
Sure. As she was removed from the book bag or the backpack, she was wrapped up in a baby light blue baby's blanket. As that was unraveled, she also had what we commonly refer to as a wife beater t-shirt, which is the A-frame muscle t-shirt that men wear sometimes.
Jason, you're not to use the term wife beater. We've all heard it's a sleeveless t-shirt.
Go ahead. That t-shirt was wrapped, one of the armholes was wrapped around her neck and covering her head. She also had on a purple onesie that said, "Be careful, boys, my daddy works out."
Okay. Now, the fact that those items, the blanket, the t-shirt wrapped around the child's face, and the items, did you learn that there were items also found when the child was discovered on the 8th?
Yes.
And what were those items?
One was a camouflage varsity restaurant t-shirt. One was a pair of blue and black camouflage type men's boxers, and one was a small sized light blue t-shirt, possibly a child's t-shirt. We later found out that those items were all taken from that house.
Was it odd to you that there were these items in the bag with the child, that whoever took the child and removed the child from the home and ultimately killed the child also stuff several items in the bag, regardless of where they came from?
Right. That would have been extremely odd for somebody kidnapping, trying to rush out to grab these random items and stuff them in this bag with the child.
And based upon what you saw with your own eyes in terms of the injuries to the child and what Dr. Darisaw told you, did you have an opinion at this point in the investigation on the morning of the 9th when you attended the autopsy as to whether or not this child was accidentally killed?
According to what we saw, my experience, Dr. Darisaw's experience, and her telling me, it was definitely not an accidental death at that point.
As a result of learning that there perhaps would not be a necessarily large amount of blood wherever the child was killed with the blunt force trauma, did that impact your decision whether or not to go back to the trailer to conduct any further search for a crime scene?
It did. We made the decision at that point not to go and look for a crime scene. As you saw in the photographs, it would have been extremely difficult to locate anything new at that point. The trailer had been gone through numerous times by numerous personnel. It was searched under a search warrant. Nothing was detected that would have shown any type of violent crime scene at all.
In all honesty, Investigator Alexander was a perfect witness. Eloquent, earnest, calm, and attentive. Don't mind me if I fangirl a little bit. I guess at this point I'd be considered Team Alexander. Day 5 of the trial took place on Monday, May 13th, 2019. Shane Kidd, who Chris McNabb had tried to accuse of putting a hit on him, took the stand.
Now, you indicated that he had multiple Facebook accounts?
Yes.
And was he texting you from all of those different ones?
Yes.
Are you absolutely certain that he was texting you in the morning hours of October the 7th when the baby was missing?
Yes.
What was he saying to you?
He was just asking me where I was. And I never, I didn't answer him. And at like 7:41 Saturday morning, he sent me a message and told me that he was wigging and tripping and needed to get out of there. And I didn't say anything to him.
What does wigging and tripping mean to those who don't smoke methamphetamines?
Paranoid.
If you could just indulge me for a minute, for those who have not smoked methamphetamine, what is the effect? I mean, what happens? Do you stay up more than you normally
yes.
would?
Yes.
Is it possible to not sleep when you smoke methamphetamines?
Yes.
Can that go for days?
Yes.
Have you done that personally?
Yes.
So literally, like, how many days in a row could you go without sleeping?
4 or 5.
With no sleep at all?
No sleep at all.
And what happens when you finally go to sleep?
You crash out. You sleep hard. You'll sleep for a day or so.
Has that happened to you?
Yes.
And on that particular day, how do you remember that 741 so specifically?
Because of what he said. And then, I don't know, it was less than an hour later, he sent me another message and told me that he couldn't find a baby. And that's when I finally responded to him and asked him, you know, what do you mean you can't find her? It ain't like she can get up and walk. You need to wake Courtney up and y'all need to find her.
And that is different from these messages that we saw earlier today?
Yes.
But you're certain about this?
I'm certain.
And the jury just heard that you've been convicted on multiple occasions of giving false information to a police officer. That's a misdemeanor offense?
Yes.
Have you ever been convicted of a felony, Shane Kidd?
Yes, in 1994.
What was that?
I was in 1994.
What was the crime, though?
Theft by taking and entering an auto.
Okay. Given the fact that you've lied to the police or pled guilty, at least on 3 different occasions, to lying to the police, why should the jury believe what you're telling them today about the morning hours of the 7th and your communications with Mr. McNabb?
I mean, what I lied to the police about was my name because I had a warrant on me. I don't see no reason why I'd make up a lie about this.
A woman named Courtney Gail Morris testified about messages she got from Chris that morning, which actually corroborated his timeline, while also making him look like an even bigger scumbag. That afternoon, during the testimony of investigator Beau Alexander, the prosecution presented the jury with Chris's messages to Courtney from the morning of Kalia's disappearance. The jury also heard Chris's jailhouse phone calls with Courtney that took place in October and December of 2017, during which Courtney expressed doubt and Chris repeatedly professed his innocence. At the end of the day, both the prosecution and the defense rested their cases. The defense's closing arguments were all bluster, trying to stir up reasonable doubt, but DA Layla Zahn's closing argument for the prosecution cut through the bullshit like a hot knife through butter.
Members of the jury, Kalia McNabb was the purest, most innocent form of human life. If you just look at her little fingers, her little nose, her sweet little chubby cheeks, those precious lips on her, she was a little angel. She was a gift to Courtney Bell and to Chris McNabb. And like all newborns are, she was tiny, she was fragile, she was dependent on both of them for care, for love, for nurturing, and for protection. Courtney Bell and Chris McNabb should have come in between any thing, whether it be a drug, any sort of environment to protect this child. And yet the evidence shows that when this child left the hospital on September 27th, she left those nurses there, those loving, caring nurses there that serve and care for newborn babies. And she walked out of that hospital, was carried out of that hospital by 2 people, unfortunately, Courtney Bell and Chris McNabb, and her fate was all but sealed. That child was doomed the moment they left that hospital. As they walked through that parking lot there at Piedmont Newton, and they got into what I like to call the methmobile.
After the closing arguments had been presented, Judge Ott recessed for the day, ordering the jury to begin deliberations in the morning. On the morning of Tuesday, May 14th, 2019, the jury deliberated for about 1 hour before returning with a verdict.
Each verdict form reads, in each of the counts against each defendant, we the jury find the defendant guilty. That's all 3 counts against Ms. Bell and all 8 counts against Mr. McNabb.
Chris McNabb had to be removed from the courtroom at one point due to his reaction to the verdict.
I need you to calm down.
I'm good. I'm just saying.
You said it five times.
Just give me my views. That's all.
Let's take Mr. McNabb out of the courtroom.
His lawyer, Anthony Carter, was cautioned that if his client couldn't control himself, he would have to hear his sentence from jail via video conference. For Chris McNabb, aggravating factors were provided to the court prior to his sentencing. District Attorney Layla Zahn told the judge about Chris's criminal history, going all the way back to simple battery in 1999 when he was 8 or 9 years old, and again in 2001 when he was 10 or 11. That's even earlier than I mentioned in last week's episode, during which I mistakenly said the law became involved in his bad behavior at age 14. That wasn't the only aggravating factor presented to the judge, however. The prosecution called to the stand Dr. Priscilla Faulkner, a mental health professional who had visited the Newton County Jail on October 14, 2017, to evaluate Chris. Anthony Carter first tried to object to the doctor being called to the stand, saying he had only learned about the witness the night before. Judge Ott was unmoved, and Dr. Faulkner took the stand.
Did you have the occasion to be working on your computer down there at the jail while you were talking to him?
I did.
And at some point in time, did Mr. McNabb tell you to look up?
He did.
And when you looked, where was he at in relation to you?
He was probably an inch or two away from the glass, okay. Right in front of my face.
So were you separated by glass?
We were separated by glass.
And what did you see when he asked you to look?
He was wearing a turtle suit, which is something that prisoners are wearing when they're on suicide risk. And that he wasn't wearing clothing under that, and he had pulled up the turtle suit and taken out his penis and was masturbating.
And did he masturbate to completion in your presence?
He did.
Thank you. Those are all the questions that I have.
Chris McNabb was not happy about Dr. Faulkner's testimony, to say the least, and continued moving his jaw after she stepped down from the stand, apparently not realizing she was seated directly behind him and could hear everything he said.
I got a question. Can I address the court, please? I just got one thing I want to say, and that's it. I'd like to say it in front of her since she's the one accusing me.
I'm going to allow you to talk when your time comes. And your time, you can say anything you want to. Is there any further evidence in offering of aggravation?
No, Judge.
Mr. Carter, do you have any evidence to offer in the way of mitigation?
I believe Mr. McNabb would like to address the court.
Okay. You may do so. You may stand up and address the court.
I'd just like the court to know, as well as everybody at home, since this is being broadcasted for whatever reasons, that I did have on a turtle suit, and it Velcros, and it wasn't on properly, and it didn't fit properly, and the Velcros were not on good. Because they don't stick, because they've been used for so many years by so many different people, and I was not masturbating at all in front of her, period. The thing fell off when I stood up, and that was it. There was none of that, and I would have liked to have told her that since she was the one making the accusation, since I'm pretty sure by the law states that I have a right to confront my witnesses who accuse me of doing wrong, so I felt like I wanted to say it in front of her since she was the one up here slandering me. And that's all I got
now,
to say.
You sure you don't want to talk about the sentencing and all of that? That was the only thing you wanted to tell the court?
I mean, I haven't heard anything about a sentence. I was just commenting on that. I understand
the charges.
That.
And I just wanted to know if you had anything you wanted to say to the court.
I mean, I got a lot to say. I got a lot to say, but I'm not going to be able to say half of it.
I don't know, because I don't know what you're going to say.
I'm innocent. I didn't do it.
Okay.
I've maintained that the whole time. I feel like there was things that were allowed to be said that should have never been allowed to have been said, that didn't have nothing whatsoever to do with the case and what was being said. Just because somebody has domestic abuse issues with their spouse doesn't mean that they would put their hands on their kids, which has also been pretty much proved that I've never touched my kids in any harmful manner whatsoever. I've never harmed my kids. I didn't even hear anything that said that I had done anything to her in front of the kids. So that doesn't make sense either. And, you know, just let the record show that I don't think I ever put my hands on her in front of those kids. And I just don't feel like just because somebody has domestic issues with the female in their life that they love, that they were just able to just say, oh, he don't love you and all that stuff just in front of everybody or whatever, which doesn't matter. But I just don't understand how you find somebody guilty of doing something to a 15-day-old baby. Because there was no evidence whatsoever that proved anything about me putting my hands on my kids. I've never done it. I never would. I don't believe in it. I was beat as a child, and I don't agree with it at all. And I would never do it. I would never do this. That's all I got to say. I would never do it. I'm innocent.
Well, I can make a lot of comments on what you said. I can make a lot of comments on the trial, but I know that was just be arguing with you or talking with you. I'll ask you one simple question. You claim you're innocent, so you tell me what sentence the man or woman that you claim did this should receive.
If you ever find out who did them, they deserve to be under the jail.
Okay. So they ought to get the maximum sentence.
Most definitely.
Okay. On the crime of malice murder, I sentence you to life in confinement without parole. On concealing the death of another, I sentence you to 10 years in confinement, consecutive or after. Count one. Do you understand each of your sentences?
Yes, sir.
I want to advise you that you have 30 days after today to file a notice of appeal.
It'll be filed.
On this case, I'm going to instruct Mr. Carter on behalf of you to file a motion for a new trial to make sure your rights are protected. If you wish to allege that Mr. Carter did not do an effective job, then we'll bring in another attorney to handle the appeal so that issue can be raised, and that's fine with Mr. Carter. He takes no offense.
I think he did an incredible job.
Well, that's fine. I'm just indicating to you that in order to claim your attorney at trial was ineffective or did not do a good job, you have to raise it at the earliest moment, which would be here.
I won't be filing anything against my attorney.
That's fine.
Now you understand why Judge Ott is another hero in this story. Chris McNabb will likely never see the outside of a prison again. His most recent institution, as listed on the Georgia DOC website, is Hayes State Prison in Tryon, Georgia.
Thank you. Does your client wish to make any statements?
I didn't do this.
Stand up. Stand up.
Y'all know I didn't do this.
Well, you and I had a conversation back.
We did.
Back in chambers on Wednesday, remember, morning? And at the time, I told you there's a difference between the reality of the situation and what you think. I explained to you exactly why you were being charged with the crimes. It wasn't that you knew about the murder. It wasn't that you anticipated the murder. It wasn't that you planned the murder. Any of those things. It was simply that you created an environment that caused your children to be put second and Mr. McNabb to be put first. As the state said in their closing, and they used the example of a rattlesnake being thrown into a room and the child being put into there. Well, your whole claim is I took him back because I wanted to have a family. In that analogy, the state used, it's just kind of like saying, your child's dead from a rattlesnake bite. Why would you put it in there? And you responded, well, I just wanted her to enjoy nature, have an appreciation of the outdoors, without appreciating the danger. Now, I'm sorry, but for you to go around chasing McNabb, doing meth, flies in the face of what any normal mother would do. We hear stories out in society, I mean out everywhere. The mother bear, they're so ferocious. Why? Because you're messing with their child. All those kind of things. And you chose methamphetamine and McNabb over a baby.
It's a sickness, but I tried to be a good mama. I love my babies.
The problem, Ms. McNabb, is that, like most criminals, you have this version of what a good mama is that is so far from the norm that, you know, you go anywhere in this county, talk to anybody who's watching this and say, is it a good mama who doesn't even care about her 14-year-old baby? Put them with a cousin. I've known of instances where mamas won't even let in the first couple of weeks of a child's life. People around the child, for fear that the child's immune system hadn't been built up, and they don't want germs brought into the child. They go to that extent. He went just the exact opposite direction. And there's just no excuse for that. On count one, I'm going to sentence you to 30 years with the first 15 years to be served in confinement in the state penitentiary, the main time on probation. On count three, I'm going to sentence you to 10 years in confinement in the run at the same time as count one. Now, do you understand your two sentences? Let the record reflect she's nodding her head slightly yes.
Courtney Marie Bell should be released on January 5th, 2033, when she is 40 years old. She was given credit for time served while awaiting trial. Her Georgia Department of Corrections record lists her most recent institution as Pulaski State Prison in Hawkinsville, Georgia. When she is released, she will serve 15 years of probation, ending when she is 55. Following their convictions, both Chris McNabb and Courtney Bell entered motions for new trials, claiming there was no evidence tying them to their daughter's death. In January of 2020, Courtney's motion claimed the state failed to show evidence that she was involved in Kalia's murder. Her motion, submitted by new attorney Eric Crawford of Monroe, Georgia, read, "The state did not prove that Ms. Bell caused Kalia's death. At best, they attempted at trial to prove that she contributed to the circumstances that led to Kalia's death." Well, no shit. That was the basis of her conviction. Not surprisingly, on November 19, 2020, Courtney's motion for a new trial was denied. In February of 2020, Chris's motion also claimed prosecutors failed to prove he had killed Kalia, and despite his proclamation during his sentencing that he would never file anything saying his attorney, Anthony Carter, hadn't done enough to defend him, his motion also cited ineffective counsel. The motion stated, "There was no physical or direct evidence that demonstrated that Mr. McNabb caused the child's death, nor was the state able to demonstrate what actually caused the child's severe injuries. The thrust of the state's case was that Mr. McNabb was a bad man that lived in a bad environment." Chris's new attorney, Titus Nichols, said, "Since there was such a large amount of circumstantial evidence, we'd ask the court to step into the role of 13th juror to determine if the state did meet its burden." They also want the court to address evidence they claim is prejudicial. On November 5, 2020, the state filed a brief in opposition of Chris's motion for a new trial. There has not yet been a decision made on this motion. Keep an eye on sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com for updates on this case. Before I end this episode, I want to take a second to remember Kalia, who at 14 days old and born a month prematurely, didn't even get a chance to begin her life. She was the most innocent of victims, who was born into the most catastrophic of circumstances. And it's stories like this that frustrate me the most, because it's just not fair. There are so many people, some who can't have children of their own, some like myself who just love children more than life itself, who would have cherished that baby, treated her with the utmost care and concern, and loved her like she deserved. Instead, she was born to a pair of meth-head first cousins in a filthy, unkempt trailer home overrun with criminals and drug addicts. She never had a chance. Rest in eternal peace, Kalia. You deserved so much more. Chris McNabb was absolutely correct when he told Judge Ott that the person who killed his daughter should be buried under the jail. May he rot in there, suffering the wrath of other inmates who might have committed crimes, but still understand that children are precious and not to be harmed. That's it for this week, guys. Join me next week for another case. If you like the show, please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. And please subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. You can also subscribe on YouTube by searching Suffer the Little Children Podcast. Visit the website at www.sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes and become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter at STLCPod. View photos related to today's case on Facebook and Instagram. Read more about today's case and many others at sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. This podcast was written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. Intro theme music is by Dream Note Music. Other music and sound effects for the show were created using sounds from audiojungle.net. Hug your babies a bit closer tonight. Until next week, bye guys.